Finding a hoodie that lasts through the season can be tough. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it year after year. Every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. The result is durable clothing that become part of your life. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life. The American Giant Classic Full Zip. Save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout.
Go loud. Magnified with Matt Cooper. Sponsored by Intact Insurance, the new name for RSA Insurance, and a new way to insure business with ease.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello, and we're back for a new series of Magnified with thanks to Intact Insurance. You may know Intact Insurance by another name, RSA Insurance. Now, there's a reason for the change of name. For brokers, this means deeper engagement and enhanced product offerings across personal and commercial lines. So remember the name. It's now Intact Insurance, and Intact Insurance has big plans for Ireland. It wants to be one of the top three insurers in the Irish market by 2030. And here on Magnified, we're delighted to be part of that journey. Our new series of podcasts follows the format of old for Magnified, considered interviews of longer duration than the format of radio and The Last Word allows me. Joining us for today's Magnified is a man who's been involved in Irish business for five decades and who doesn't intend stopping now that he has stepped away from his latest time with CityJet, the business which he initially set up in 1993, then left in 2000 and returned to in 2015. We don't just talk about CityJet and why he was so obsessed with getting involved in the airline industry, but we talk about the rest of his career as well in financial services and as being an entrepreneur. If you want to know what drives people to set up and then develop businesses, I think you'll get a good feel from it from our guest today, Pat Byrne. And towards the end, we'll also talk to him about what it's like watching his two rugby-playing sons, Harry, who's with Leinster, and Ross, who used to be with Leinster, now with Gloucester, what it's like with them on the field of play to be watching as a parent. All of that to come in this edition of Magnified. And again, our thanks to Intact Insurance. Pat Byrne, I think the first time I might have interviewed you would have been back around 1993, that far back around the time when you were setting up CityJet.
Yeah.
And you've only now finally stepped away for CityJet for the last time. Well, it mightn't be the last time given you've stepped away from it before and you stepped back in again. But you're saying you've gone from CityJet. And I thought it would be a good opportunity to have a chance to talk to you about your business career and why it is that, and I reckon you must be just started into your 70s, you're not giving up on your business career and that you've decided to continue with a business consultancy. So thank you for taking the time to join me.
No, pleasure to be here, Matt. Yeah, we go back an awful long time.
Yeah, I've interviewed you countless times, mainly about the airline industry, but actually, you were in other businesses before you got into airlines, which I think is probably relevant to what you're going to do now because your experience goes beyond airlines, doesn't it?
It does. I spent the first 20 years of my career in financial services. I started in the bank. I joined Chase and Bank of Ireland because back then in the early 70s, an American bank couldn't get, or any foreign bank couldn't get a license unless they teamed up with an Irish domiciled bank. So they formed, it was Chase Manhattan, Bank of Ireland. So I got a job in Chase and Bank of Ireland for 3 years. Didn't like it.
Doing what?
I started in the ledger room, manually checking signatures on accounts because there was no computerization in those days. And then I advanced to the lofty title of chief cashier. So I actually ended up being in charge of six other cashiers. I was 19. The youngest of the other six was 26. So I went to the manager. I said, I think you made a mistake in my pay packet this month. I mean, with the new job, I'm on the same money. And he said, get out of here, you cheeky pup. He said, do you realise what an opportunity you have at 19 years of age and the responsibility you've been given? And you're going to build a great career in banking out of that. I left the bank shortly after that.
Okay. Was it boring or what was it?
Sorry?
Was it boring to do?
It was very boring. The only part I liked was the interaction with the customers. And basically, I got my next job by that kind of interaction, because this guy called Mervyn Percival used to come in every day or every few days making lodgements and whatever. And I got chatting to him, and he caught me in a bad mood one day, and he said, "You're really pissed off, aren't you?" And I said, "I am." And he said, "How would you like to come and work for me? I have an insurance brokerage around the corner in Dawson Street." So he said, "Come in for an interview." And I did. And I ended up joining a company called Savings and Investments, which is now Corn Market, which is the very large affinity group brokerage. It caters for all of the teachers, nurses, all of the public sector unions. So I went in as a trainee sales guy. It was a recession. It was 1975. Britain was on a three-day week with coal strikes and the miner strikes and all that kind of thing. So over here, we were getting the tail end of it. And so our inquiries, we used to advertise in the front of the Independent and the Irish Times, our inquiries dried up for savings plans. So we had to do something different. So I was sitting in a teacher's sitting room one Friday, November, very bleak Friday. And I was trying to sell him another policy, because he'd bought a policy off Mervyn, actually, 2 years previously. So I was trying to do a re-canvas and, you know, and he couldn't afford any more than £10 a month. So, and he spotted in my bag a lovely little leaflet, a flyer with a medicine bottle and a blue rose sticking out of it. He said, and he saw the figure £7 a month on that. And he said, "What's that?" I said, "That's not for you." I said, "That's a thing called permanent health insurance." I said, "You're a teacher. You're well covered. You know, you don't need that." And he said, no. He said, "I'm the secretary of the local branch of the IMTO. We've been collecting for the last 20 years for one of our members who had a football accident. There's a gap in our cover." And I couldn't believe it. I went back to the office instead of going to the pub, researched it. And we went to underwriters in the UK, and we actually designed a scheme, which we call the Salary Protection Scheme. And that's basically how we redirected the whole business of savings and investments. And we captured the whole teacher market and the nurses market, then doctors, and it spread from there. So,
and did you become a part owner of that business?
I owned 40% of it. Yeah.
And then you sold to Woodchester.
We sold it to Woodchester in December 87. We sold 75% of it to Woodchester, to Craig McKinney.
The late Craig McKinney, who was some character.
He was an incredible character in more ways than one.
Okay, well, explain that to me. He was, I remember him as this chain-smoking Scotsman. Yep. Who also had a penchant for a glass of whiskey, and who loved playing polo. I think he actually, when he left Ireland after he sold Woodchester, he ended up in Argentina.
That's right.
And he was a man who was, he loved telling the media stories.
Yes.
He was a fascinating character. Mm. Now, I would have had limited interactions with him, interviewing him. By the sounds of what you're saying, is you might have had a more fraught relationship with him?
Slightly more fraught, I would say. He was quite a difficult guy. There was only one way, and that was the Craig McKinney way. He wanted me to go to Europe and develop the leasing business. His main business was car leasing, and he wanted me to be the development director, marketing director for expansion into Europe. And I wanted to stay with the insurance brokerage business, because I felt now we were part of a PLC, we have a war chest, let's go and acquire other brokers and bolt them on, and let's really take this affinity marketing of, you know, benefits to public sector unions, let's take it to the UK, let's look at other countries as well. And he didn't support that idea. So on the third time of him asking me to move to London and go into the leasing business, I declined. Let's say there was a construction after that as to...
He had a volcanic temper, didn't he?
Our parting of the ways.
He had a volcanic temper?
He had a ferocious temper, yeah. Yeah.
So you really got the full force of that. He would have been maybe given the Scottish, an Alex Ferguson type approach, was it?
Well, it was hairdryer treatment most weeks, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he was a tough guy. Very clever, incredibly bright. Came from a very humble background in Scotland. People forget that he was Scottish. You know, not Irish, but And he started off in photocopy sales, photocopy machine sales, and that type of thing. But a phenomenal work ethic, really bright, superb at reading numbers, unbelievable. For a guy who wasn't an accountant, he was actually amazing. So huge energy. I mean, lots of things to admire about him. But he was, if you weren't going to play it his way, then that was going to be difficult.
Will there also have been perhaps a clash in the sense that from the way you describe him, he's very entrepreneurial, but clearly your career shows that you're very entrepreneurial as well. And yeah. Necessarily two people, strong-willed, wanting to do things, are not going to get on.
Yeah, I think there were really three egos in the room. There was Mervyn was still in the business. Mervyn was 13 years older than me. He was the 60. He was the 60. I was the 40 when we were selling the 75% of it. And Mervyn had become accustomed to, you know, letting me run things. So Craig was brilliant at divide and conquer. So he sort of, you know, cozied up to Mervyn and sort of they kind of really got at me, and he was sort of encouraging Mervyn to take, you know, take the front seat again and whatever, all this kind of pressure to try and make me want to go to London to get away from this, and it didn't work.
So you decided to leave?
I decided to leave, yeah. I
to do what?
The rest of my shares. I had two ideas in my head, and I had a lot of money in my back pocket for a relatively young man. I was only 37 when I came out of there. One was I was very interested in setting up a children's private hospital.
I haven't actually heard of anyone thinking of that.
Yeah, I wanted to do a Black Rock for kids because I wanted to form, again, using the affinity marketing approach, I wanted to form a medical club for kids. And that way I felt that I could avoid all of the regulation. I could avoid, not being given a license to transact, because the government at the time were very protective of the VHI, and other players were only beginning to look at coming into the health market. I wanted to actually have a medical club for paediatric medicine. So I was researching that, and I was also interested in aviation. I was a pilot.
Yeah, well, before we get to the aviation stuff, I mean, why did you not go ahead with that? Was there just too many barriers to entry on it?
No, I didn't think there were many barriers to entry. And I actually had, you know, I was very confident that I was actually going to be able to circumvent the barriers. It really was a hot idea. And I was very, very keen on it. And I got distracted. I got distracted probably because I love aviation. And I was I've been a pilot for many years before that. I had my own aircraft. And I saw an opportunity in the aviation market. I saw a serious gap in the market being left, particularly by Aer Lingus on Dublin-London. And I had come across London City Airport, was fascinated by it. It was very, very new at that stage. And I thought that, you know, really, this is something that should be done, a service from Dublin into the centre of London, into London City Airport. And initially, I was approached by British Aerospace, who made the 146, if you remember, our famous four-engine jet. And they said, look, we hear you could be somebody, you might be somebody who could help us. We want to sell.
So how did they become aware of you?
They heard of me. I don't know, but they knocked on my door, literally. I had an office in Plansky.
You hadn't set up CityJet at this
stage? No, I hadn't set up CityJet. I was dabbling in aircraft leasing at the time as a sideline. I had bought some military trainers and I leased them into the Air Corps, which was something unusual as well, because I wasn't aware anybody else had ever leased hardware, military hardware. So I bought three military trainers in the US, brought them to Ireland, and we put them up in Gormanston, where the Air Corps used to train. And we did what was called a washout program for the pilot cadets back then. And now it's reverted to type again. When a young person decides to apply to the Air Corps to become a pilot, they do desktop aptitude testing only. They don't sit in an airplane. If they're accepted, they're sent off to the Curra, to infantry school for 12 months. They come back and then they step into an airplane in Baldonnell for the first time. And if they don't make it, they have to stay in the army, not the Air Corps. So everybody loses. So I went to the Air Corps with an idea that we should do this washout program. And with these particular aircraft, similar to what the Air Corps had, but they were lighter, we could go back to Gormanston, where military training used to take place, and give every guy who got the aptitude, or girl, got the aptitude test, give them 10 hours with an instructor in our aircraft and measure the rate of learning. And then you'd know with certainty they're going to make it, they're not going to make it. So I did that for 2 years. And it was, that's how British Aerospace heard about me. And they knocked on my door and said, will you help us sell this airplane to Aer Lingus?
Sorry, just a minute. Did you ever regret not going ahead with the children's private hospital?
Many times. Yeah, I do regret it. Yeah, I do. I think there was a time for it. And I think it could have been very successful. And it appealed to me as well. Altruistically, it appealed to me. I actually really thought, I've always been sort of taken with the idea of trying to provide service. And I actually thought that was going to be a really good service of real value and benefit to people. It was very tangible.
It's an interesting idea. Come back to the airline, so, and come back to CityJet. And setting it up, you set it up originally with just the one route, Dublin to London.
Yeah, because I got so pissed off at Aer Lingus. I mean, I went to Aer Lingus to try and sell them the 146 on behalf of British Aerospace, and the meeting lasted 55 minutes. And I felt that the attitude coming across from the other side of the table was arrogant. And I was so annoyed, I went to Keely's pub, which is right out in Clockham, right beside the airport. Went in for a cup of coffee, not a pint. I had my colleague Luke Mooney, who was my mentor, and Luke and myself sat down, and I said to Luke, you know somebody, you know the assistant secretary in the Department of Transport, don't you? This was before the IAA was set up. And he said, I do. I said, let's go and see him. Let's find out what we have to do to get a license. And that's literally what we did. We walked in the door of the Department of Transport, came out with four or five big ring binders. I set about hiring a few people, thankfully, who knew an awful lot more about it than I did. And we started writing the manuals and our application for the license. And I started raising money, and I put in my own capital as the seed capital. But I went to private individuals. I went to institutions that I knew from my savings and investments days, and I raised the money. And then I was nervous about starting. So then I went to Richard Branson. I knew I needed the cover of a big brand to get it off the ground. So I went to Branson then at that stage.
So it was Virgin CityJet, was it?
It was Virgin CityJet, yeah. We had a franchise using his brand.
Okay, tell me about Richard Branson, because I've heard all sorts of stories about him, and maybe there's a younger generation who might not be familiar as to how big a personal brand and business brand Virgin was for him back in the late 20th century.
He is mercurial. It's like trying to date a rock star, I would imagine. And he has the shortest attention span of anybody I've ever met. It's on to the next new idea every 17 seconds. But I found him very personable. I developed a pretty good relationship with him. But the princes in his castle were not happy with that. You know, they were envious of that. And, you know, that didn't go down well with them. So they were quite obstructive in trying to derail the deal. But he liked it. He wanted to do it.
Because he was doing transatlantic stuff at the time, wasn't he?
He was doing transatlantic, yeah. He was really pitching himself against BA. BA were the enemy. He always had to have an enemy to fight.
And you would have had in Dublin, London, Aer Lingus in particular, which would have been going through a lot of financial difficulty in that period as well.
It was.
And you'd have had an emerging Ryanair.
That's right, yeah. So we were fitting into the kind of sweet spot that he was kind of interested in. And he liked the concept, and he decided he would do it, but his team didn't want to do it. So that was quite difficult.
And what financial basis did Virgin come in on? Was it basically you had to pay them a fee for the use of the name?
We had to pay them 3% off the top, which was heavy. So they got 3% off our top line.
And what did you get for that? What did you get for that?
We got they sold the seats. We got the VS brand, their IATA code. Their call centres and booking systems would sell the seats. It was sold as a Virgin flight. We had to live up to the Virgin standard. So he had this mad idea that if we were going to fly, even though it was a very short flight, an hour's flight, we had to do the Virgin upper class on board. And we had to have four cabin crew. We only had 85 seats, but we had four cabin crew. We had real china, real knives and forks, real champagne. It was not
for everybody on the flight.
Anybody buying a business seat. But half of the people flying with us wanted to buy the business seat because they actually loved what was going on. And, it really was a fantastic product. It was economic suicide, but it was a fantastic product.
I can only imagine if Michael O'Leary was to listen to this, he'd be scoffing, because that was exactly the type of stuff that Ryanair in the early days was doing, because Tony Ryan wanted it. And O'Leary got rid of all of that before you started doing it on the Dublin-London route.
Yeah. But we did modify Richard's thinking on that after a few months. He said, we can't keep this up. you know, we're going to go bust. So we did modify the service. But the customer care aspect, we never dropped. We always had that. And that's one thing I really would say, I certainly learned from Richard Branson, that he genuinely has the ethos of supreme customer care. And he's very, very good at it. And always face the music, always own up when it's your fault, always say sorry, and always compensate.
So you did that for about 7 or 8 years.
Mm, yeah.
How big did CJET get in that time?
That time, well, we left Virgin after 2.5 years. Bit of a row.
What sort of row?
Well, they were holding on to our money because they were collecting our money, and we would have a delay in receiving our revenue every month, and I got really fed up with that. And they were playing silly buggers, really, to be honest. It wasn't him, but people on his team were playing silly buggers with us. So I basically said to him, we can't continue with this. We don't love you anymore. We have to go independent. We'll deliver the CityJet brand, and we'll get our own IATA code and all that kind of thing. And initially he was very defensive, and he didn't want to do that, and he started going very legal, and we had to go legal as well. And I rang him one, again, everything seems to happen to me on Fridays, but I rang him on a Friday morning, and he was in his bath, as he told me on the call, and he said, if I knew it was you, I wouldn't have answered the phone. And I said, Richard, while you're in your bath, I said, your lawyers are clocking up more money right now, and my lawyers are clocking up money. This is ridiculous. I'm coming to see you. We're going to sort this out this weekend.
Is this going to his Caribbean island?
No, no. I went to his house in Oxford. He had two houses. He had a house in Holland Park in London, which he ran his office there, even though the headquarters of Virgin was in Crawley in Sussex. But he had an office in Holland Park where he had his townhouse, and then he had a beautiful house in Oxford. So I went to Oxford and we sorted it out.
How did you sort it out?
We just looked at each other, and I said, this is ridiculous, isn't it? And he said, I don't want to fight with you. I said, I don't want to fight with you either. Well, can we still be friends? I said, of course we can still be friends. But I have to go my own way, Richard. This is not going to work. And he said, okay. He said, I'll talk to Frances, who was his in-house counsel, whom I got on very well with. And she called off the externals, and we did a very simple agreement, and it was done within 2 weeks.
And how did you then develop the business after that?
With a lot of difficulty. We at that stage, we probably had, we were probably up to about, we only had about four aircraft. Cash was tight, really tight. So I was looking for more investors. And I ended up with bringing in Malmo Aviation, which were Swedish airline based in Malmo, funnily enough. But they had been accidentally bought by the Crawford Vicklund family, who were the heirs to the Tetra Pak fortune.
Oh.
And they had a guy managing the family office investments. He never told them that he'd bought an airline for them. So they suddenly found themselves with this airline, ironically flying the 146 as well. So I went to see them many, many times. I was told no 6 or 7 times. But on the 8th time, they said maybe. And I took that to be very positive. And I went to other investors, including Paul Coulson. And Paul decided he would have a go at this with the Swedes. But we had everything pretty well wrapped up. And we were in our boardroom, and Paul said, can I have a word with you? Can you step outside here for a second? And he said, there's just one more thing. And I said, what's that? He said, we're going to put in $4.5 million between us. This was one thing. He said, you have to go through the car wash. I said, what's the car wash? And that was the first time I ever heard of examinership. The car wash was examinership. And this was early days of examinership. This was 1996. And I had to put the company through examinership.
Just explain to people who are not familiar with the term. The examinership was brought in the early 90s, basically to save the Goodman Group and its debts from Iraq.
Yep.
It was a way to ensure a company didn't have to go into receivership or liquidation.
Yep.
But it still meant that existing owners and creditors would take something of a bath. Yep. You're going to get the car wash. So yep. Just explain what happened then.
So I had to basically, learn pretty quickly what the whole process was about. And the new investors were making it, and our existing investors were going to come again. But they were only going to, everything was made conditional on us restructuring the balance sheet. And that meant that creditors were going to be...
Get rinsed,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And shareholders, I mean, were you diluted?
I went to zero.
You became an employee of the company?
I became an employee of the company. I got wiped out, yeah.
What was that like for you?
Horrible. Horrible. And, you know, but it was...
How much did you lose? Did you lose millions?
I didn't lose millions, but I had put in a fair few bob, but I knew that it was... I was not... And I hadn't got the reserves to go again. And if I couldn't go again, I would lose. And that's actually what happened. So I had a choice. If I walked out, I think the thing would have fallen. It would have fallen. And I didn't want to do that. We had 450 employees. So I wanted to try and save it and have a future for the business. So I stayed in, but I took a bath. At least the creditors got more than I got. Some got 25% or 25 cents in the dollar. I got zero. I still have the check for my shares at home. It's 10 pence. I got 10 pence for my shares.
You framed that, did you?
I did.
I suppose you have to maintain a sense of humour about something like that, do you?
Well, you do, because you knock you flat.
You do.
But that's life. That's life, you know.
But you still stayed with the business for another 4 years or so, did you?
I did stay with the business. I stayed with the business. We went through a few more investor rounds. I persuaded Air France, that I had developed a very strong relationship with, to come in for 25%, and I ultimately persuaded them to take it all. And officially, we sold the business to Air France, but the reality is we parked the business with Air France, and we became part of the Air France group.
But the other people that you brought in, the likes of Paul Coulson, did they make money out of it?
Yes, they did, because I helped secure their and the existing shareholders who came forward. They didn't lose any money, because I engineered a sale and lease back on some of the aircraft. And I created a special purpose leasing company for them. And basically, I got them an Air France guarantee to ultimately buy out the aircraft. And they actually recovered their money.
This sounds, Pat, like you did an awful lot of juggling during that decade.
Yeah.
And you managed to catch some balls and you didn't manage to catch others.
Yeah, yeah. But I learned a lot.
And this is all relevant to your new business, I think, as well, as a consultant. When you learn from failure and having to chase things down, that gives you a much better perspective, presumably, than might be coming from a lot of other consultants.
I think it does, because, you know, I have a lot of scars. But if you don't learn from your scars, then you really have doubly lost, because you have the pain of the getting the scar in the first place. But if you don't learn from it and take something positive out of it to avoid a situation or to short circuit a situation in the future, then you're a fool. And I think I have learned very, very well from the scars.
Take us back sort of to the turn of the century. You have left CityJet, and we'll get back to when you returned to CityJet later. Mm-hmm. You did other things. You went into Vision Consulting first, and then you set up Rainmaker. So tell us about that.
Yeah, Vision was brilliant. Vision, I don't know if you know Billy Glennon, but Vision really came out of Accenture. Well, they were called Andersons in those days before they changed the name to Accenture. But Vision was an incredible, probably the most exciting company I ever came across in my career. There were 500 people in it. It was a mix of IT, process, human behavior, business change, doing really exciting projects. You know, from hydroelectric to turbine manufacturing, redoing the processes to the first. They did the first interbank bank, Dime Bank in New York. They built the first online mortgage company, Intelligent Finance, for the Halifax in the UK. So really groundbreaking stuff. And they did a huge project with how to break bands, new bands, cheaper for Warner Music, which was a really exciting project. So the diversity of what they were capable of doing was phenomenal.
And what were you doing for them?
I was the business. They brought me in as business development director. So looking for new business, looking for opportunities, and basically then I would get involved in the projects. But I brought a project to them. I, through my aviation connections, guy I had dealt with in aviation had become the CEO of very large engineering company in the UK, Atkins. You know Atkins?
No.
They're the largest engineering company in the UK. So the London Underground had been privatised, or public-private partnership, and they broke it into two-thirds, one-third. And two-thirds was a consortium called Metronet. So they had Bombardier, Atkins, Thames Water, Seagreen, Sea Energy, anyway, one of the electricity companies, Balfour Beatty. So they had a 30-year contract with the London Underground that they would run the London Underground for 30 years, replace the rolling stock, replace the platforms, replace the track, and hand it back in better condition 30 years on. And meanwhile, you know, they could make money along the way, and they all had vested interest in selling their things to the London Underground. So I asked for an introduction from my pal. I went to see Metronet, and I walked in the door, and I said to this guy, Terry, I said, how long have you got? And he said, I'm only seeing you, he said, because of our mutual friend, Robin Southwell, he said. So you've got exactly 20 minutes. 3 hours later, I left with the gig, and I bypassed the tender process, and I got the gig to transform. they were penalised for trains breaking down in rush hour, 200 grand a pop. They were penalised for dirty carriages when the trains would go in for cleaning at night and come back out. Mystery shoppers, all that kind of stuff, graffiti, all of that. So we got the gig, and that was the thing I was most proud of in Vision. And we got rid of graffiti on the Underground, among other things, and improved track performance, all that type of thing. But I found that absolutely fascinating, really fascinating. Down the tunnels at night, walking the track, observing the work practices, incredible. It was like really cutting-edge stuff in one of the oldest businesses in the world.
So why did you leave that?
Because I decided to leave Vision, and I wanted to set up my own. So I set up Rainmaker.
So this again is this thing, never an employee, but wanting to be the boss.
Correct.
Even if being the boss means a lot of the time that you are working for investors.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So why do that? I mean, why is it you think that you would get control to be in charge of things, even if you are answering to investors, but you're running things day to day? Or was it for the belief that you would end up at the end getting a sizable share of the profits? What's the motivation?
The motivation is to build something that I believe in, basically. And, you know, if I believe in it sufficiently, you know, I would say forever if I really believe in it. But I felt that I just didn't. I felt there was more opportunity for me going on my own at that stage. I just didn't want to stay there for a number of reasons. I wasn't sure where Vision was heading. And I decided I'd like to try and create something to my style that would work for me.
Okay, so you went to Rainmaker. What was that?
Well, I set that up.
Okay.
That was just an idea on the kitchen table. And so Rainmaker Business Catalyst. So just one-man band to begin with. And then my colleague in Vision, Brendan Fuller, and great pal, he joined me. And we started doing consulting, mostly in the banking sector here in Ireland and in Germany. And we were again doing re-engineering the processes, finding out where the oily rag was stuck in the pipe, whether it was in process or in IT, but mostly in process and in behavior, and just really trying to repolish the engine, the delivery engines in these businesses. So it was mostly in financial services that we actually went to work. And by accident, we came across a small IT company that somebody asked us to take a look at, and they were building a new type of technology. And we advised the shareholders that we said, look, if you don't find some customers for this thing, it's, you know, if they keep building the boat, we're going to have to take the boathouse down to get the thing out. So we better get it down to the water before we put the superstructure on it and find out where it's going to float. So I said I'd try and get something in aviation, and Brendan said he'd try and get something in banking, and we'd see how we could actually apply the technology that was very exciting at the time. And aviation won, because we landed a few gigs, and especially in North America.
What sort of things for airlines?
We basically saw that in North America there was an enormous problem with how you pay crew, because the unions insist on very stringent rules on duty times and all kinds of complications. And all airlines in the States, they have a crew audit department. So they have to audit the payroll every month. You could have 40 people auditing the pay before they actually make the pay. And the accuracy of the pay was about 90%. And I've never in my life met anybody who has come back to their company to say, I was overpaid. You only meet the people who say, I was underpaid. So we built an engine that could actually sit on top of their crew scheduling system and the flight operations system, talk to those and calculate in real time what the crew were going to be paid, and then be able to allow the crew to see themselves online what they're going to get paid and make their queries online to the administrators. So you didn't need the 40 people in the back office anymore in auditing it, and the accuracy went up to the high 90s. Which was enormous. So one of our first customers was JetBlue, which was amazing to get JetBlue. Little company like us in Sandymount over Mulligan's pub with 23 people. And, you know, but that's gone on to be very successful. Really, really successful.
You sold that business along the way.
Sold it in 23 to Skymetrics in Germany. But it's I mean, the companies that are on, that you know, use that system, Air Canada, WestJet, Alaska, JetBlue, PSA, which is owned by American, and UPS. I mean, these are big companies that Endeavour, which is part of Delta, Canada Jazz, which is 30% owned by Air Canada as well. I mean, it's about 30 airlines using this engine, which is fantastic. So we sold that in 23, yeah.
So then in 2015, was it, you went back to CityJet?
I went back, yeah, because...
No, why? I saw in one interview that you did many years back, you were described as what's... Some people... Michael O'Leary is dismissive of people he calls aerosexuals.
Yes.
He said who are obsessed with airplanes and aircrafts. He just sees it very much as a business to make money out of.
And he's right.
Whereas you, again, I found a piece suggested, you actually applied to join the RAF as a teenager.
I did, yeah, I did. I wanted to be a fighter pilot, yeah.
Okay, you became a non-fighter pilot afterwards.
Afterwards, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And did you continue to fly your own planes?
No, I gave that up a long time ago. I gave that up for a very simple reason, that I was doing enough flying to be legal, but not enough to be safe. You know, I was doing enough to keep my license alive.
Yeah.
But flying will kill you if you're not current. And it's a very, very dangerous pursuit. It really is. And you've really got to be in the full of your health, and you've got to be very current. And you've got to recognise if you're not current, then you're not good enough.
As well as the aerosexuals thing, you know, some people who are obsessed with aircraft and airlines and all the rest of it and stuff. There's also, it's one of these industries as well, that said, how do you make a fortune, or a small fortune in airlines? And they say, start with a very big fortune.
Start with a very big one, yeah.
And it's a way of losing money. So what brought you back into CityJet in 2015?
What brought me back was, you know, we were going reasonably all right with the software business, but it was hard graft trying to, you know, I was going backwards and forwards to the States every month and traveling all over the States. I mean, it was just incredible. My air miles were savage. It was a slow burn. We knew we would eventually get there. Got to a point, anyway, I kept a close eye on what was going on with CityJet. Air France sold CityJet in 2014 to Intro Aviation, which is a company in Nuremberg in Germany. And they were opportunists, and they didn't really have a strategy. So I always had a soft spot for CityJet, and I always was concerned about what would happen. And I could see that it wasn't great. So I went to Falco, which was the main lessor. They leased half of the fleet to CityJet, and the other half were actually owned by the airline.
How big was CityJet at this stage?
This stage they had 20 aircraft, probably 600-700 people, 600 people, I would think. So I went to Jeremy Barnes, the CEO. I knew him very, very well because I had leased... Falco used to be British Aerospace Asset Management. So I knew, I had a long relationship with the guys. And I said to Jeremy, do you see what I see? And he said, I do. And he said, have you got a plan? And I said, well, funny enough, I do. I said, I think that it's not going to survive with its own brand. It's not going to survive as a franchisee. I said, it needs to be converted into a wet lease operator.
What's a wet lease operator?
A wet lease operator is where you fly for other airlines, for bigger airlines. You paint your aircraft in their colours, you wear their uniform, you deliver their service. So you show up with the aircraft and the crew and the maintenance. And they take care of the fuel, navigation charges, landing charges, handling charges, all that kind of stuff.
Why do the bigger airlines do that? Why do they not just have their own aircraft and own staff to do that?
Because very often what they don't want to do is have to go through all the trouble and expense of taking on a smaller type of aircraft, different maintenance, different everything. Also, they find that if they have it in-house, it will get corrupted by the unions in the mainline who will be insisting on the same conditions. And it becomes inexpensive and productivity is not necessarily as good as you would get from outsourcing it. So it's really a cost control. It's a cost control and a cost certainty.
Even though they're paying a margin to you, presumably, over your costs of actually running this airline.
It's still cheaper.
Okay.
So I went for that plan, and Jeremy was, said he'd back it, and he would come to the rescue, and he'd put in the first 14 million, and he did. And he said, there's only one condition, though. He said, I'm not going to do it unless, and I said, unless what? He said, unless you go back in as CEO. I said, but I'm running a software business. So I went to my colleague, Brendan, and I said, what do you think? And I said, look, you know, really, we're in slow burn mode at the moment. So it doesn't need both of us. So we'd agreed that Brendan would run the software business and I'd go back into CityJet.
Okay.
But I kept my shares.
And how did you find the experience of going back into CityJet 15 years later on? Also, as somebody, you must have been hitting around 60 at that stage.
I was, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I was. I found it strange, really, really strange, you know, and there was this voice in my head all the time saying, you never go back. And I wanted to prove to myself that was wrong, that you could go back and be successful. But I found it really strange because when I went back in, I mean, I've been out of it for 14 years and I found that it had become so institutionalized. It was no longer the small little regional entrepreneurial business. It was had been part of Air France, which is an enormous organization. And it really had become very, very institutionalized and very siloed. So it was a classic example of how a business had to be completely restructured and the culture had to be rebuilt, and it was an amazing experience. We actually set up in the offices. I took down all the walls internally. There were loads and loads of offices. Took everything away, and we put up construction stuff internally, but it was to show that we're going to change. We're going to reconstruct the culture and the way we do things. So it was a. It was a phenomenal experience, actually, of change. And the shareholders were anxious to grow quickly. So we really, we went at warp speed. I mean, we went from, at that stage, about 18, 19, 20 aircraft of one type. Within 3 years, we had taken on 30 CRJ 900s on top of the British airspace aircraft. And we also had a big adventure with the Sukhoi, with the Russian jet, which was extraordinary. So we ended up going, we had five customers, airline customers for wet lease, and we dismantled our own scheduled flying on Dublin London City and Dublin and a few other places, mostly Dublin London City. So it was a massive transformation program.
And did it work for you?
It did work. I mean, we got up to, believe it or not, before COVID, we got up to 48 aircraft. Which was across three different types, which was an incredible achievement.
But COVID then destroyed you.
Wiped us out, yeah. Wiped us out. Overnight, we went from five customers to one because four out of...
And you were easy to cut when they were looking to cut costs.
Force majeure in the contract. They just, four of them invoked force majeure. The only customer that didn't invoke force majeure was SAS.
Why was that?
Two reasons, I think. I think that, well, probably, well, two reasons falling into one. I think they had invested heavily in, not in terms of money, but in terms of effort and energy, they'd invested very heavily in us being their regional arm, outsourcing their regional activity to us. Because in the process with SAS, they asked us to acquire two of their subsidiaries, which we did. We acquired Blue One in Helsinki in Finland, and we acquired Kimber in Denmark, and we absorbed that into the business, into CityJet. That's how CityJet grew so quickly. And I think they said, look, we've invested in this emotionally, psychologically, every other way, and there will be a recovery, hopefully. So they said, you know, if we have to go and try and build this again with somebody else, there mightn't be anybody else to build it with. So they said, let's support each other. Like the two drunks supporting each other in the swing doors of the bar, in the saloon. And no sooner had you know, recovery had come, and we were beginning to grow again, SAS went into Chapter 11.
The car wash.
Because you can't write it. You know, you can't write this stuff. I mean, it's just, it is unbelievable how many times are you going to be tested in your career. You know, it's,
and did this hit you personally financially as well? Were you a shareholder in CityJet?
I was a shareholder in CityJet, so I got wiped again. But I was a shareholder. I had a mechanism. Sorry, I was more built around share options than you know, putting in money at the beginning. But I was a significant enough single digit shareholder, and that got wiped again for the second time. So
what did that feel like?
Bad again. Yeah.
Okay, but the company then was rescued. You stayed with it, but you're now leaving it, or you left it last year?
Yeah, because we had to restructure for the third time. We had to do examinership for the third time last summer.
But the business was saved?
The business was saved, yeah.
And now you said enough is enough?
Enough is enough, yeah. Enough is enough. At this stage, and I think that it's got a really, really excellent chance now of being successful. SAS have been very loyal to it, and we're a major player in the restructuring. But we also had a merger going on as well with a Spanish company, and they actually tried to sink us during the examinership. So, I mean, only I know that it's all true. You'd say, no, it's not. It couldn't possibly happen. There cannot be that many different twists and turns in a small, relatively small company's life, but there have been.
How do you remain personally positive throughout all of that, or do you remain personally positive?
Oh, extremely. Extremely. I really do.
You know, how do you manage that?
I have a great sense of humour. I really have a terrific sense of humour. You know, I that sounds arrogant, but I do. And it's
you're capable of laughing at adversity, are
I
you?
Laugh at myself. I mean, I would be very self-deprecating. I do laugh at myself, but I also believe in certain things, and I think that, you know, the effort that a number of people have made, you know, over the years in CityJet, faced with adversity, they didn't fold. We didn't fold. We didn't give in. We tried to find solutions, and we did. And against a lot of odds, we found solutions. You know, you might say, well, why didn't we make a fortune? You know, timing, I suppose. But the thing is that I'm extremely confident that I've really learned how to deal with issues, how to recognise what the real faults actually are, and how to do something about it, and redirect, and rebuild.
And in your new consultancy Afterburn, presumably it won't just be aviation clients or financial. The lessons you've learned, you think, how will you be able to apply them or offer them as use to other people?
I think they're totally translatable. You know, I think aviation, it must be one of the toughest, if not the toughest, business, and especially regional aviation. It's extremely tough because you're so challenged, and you learn about so many things and supply chains and it's a lot of stuff, operational stuff, compliance, safety, absolute paramount importance at all. You can never drop the ball on that. So you have to serve an awful lot of masters at the same time. You have to multitask quite a lot. You have to have very good structures and processes. I think that is very translatable into any business. Business is business. The principles are the same. And I think it's about looking at what is the real problem, identifying what the real problem is, and you know, avoiding groupthink. And in aviation, there's a lot of groupthink. In most businesses, there's a lot of groupthink, and there's a lot of herd instinct. and safety in numbers and all that kind of stuff. And I really think that, and people talk about innovation, and to me innovation is a very simple thing. Innovation is critical thinking in action. That's what it actually is. Some people might call it common sense. I would call it critical thinking in action. And to challenge what other people do not challenge. Challenge groupthink. Don't go with the flow all of the time. Recognise that you're in your own boat. You need to be in your own boat. And, you know, I wrote recently about, I'm a great fan of Ambles, you know, they have a great line in a song about, you know, it's the storm we share. You know, we share the same storm, but we're in our own boat. It's up to us to deal with the storm. So you get industry storms all of the time, but don't follow the groupthink. Attend to your own boat, re-rig your boat. Make sure that you can get through the storm yourself. Don't be waiting for everybody else to show you how to do it.
One thing I'm going to ask you to finish, which is completely unrelated to aviation and business. You have four children. The two youngest are two very well-known rugby players.
Yep.
Both Ireland internationals. One with Leinster, one now with Gloucester. Harry and Ross Byrne. How difficult as a father is it to watch two sons competing often for the one position on the team?
Very. And if their mother was in here, she'd be telling you that as well. No, it is very difficult. But yeah, very, very difficult. But the two guys are they're both ferociously competitive animals in their own way, and competitive with each other. But they're the best of mates, and they help each other an awful lot. But it has been over the years very, very difficult. And professional sport, and I know you're mad about sport as well. But professional sport is, it's very, very tough. The highs are great, but there's way more lows than highs. Way more lows than highs in a professional sports person's career.
Injuries, not getting selected.
Not getting selected, yeah. I mean, I wrote a book a number of years ago called Fueled by Belief on my first incarceration in City Jet mainly, and a few other bits and pieces. But I cryptically named the chapters, you know, but I had one chapter which I called... You're not really draft, but you're not playing on Saturday. What's the And I think that a lot of people in sport will identify with that, and you know what coaches tell you, and the smoke they blow up your rear end, you know, and that type of thing. But no, it's very tough. It's a very tough career, but yeah, it's been a great journey. I mean, the lads have been playing at a good level of rugby for a number of years, and all the way up as you know, kids, teenagers. You know, schools, clubs, and now you know, professional. I wouldn't change it. It still is a great journey, phenomenal journey. It's just more complicated now because we have to get over and back to the UK as well as.
Or you still go and watch Ross playing his matches, do you?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. And Harry did a tour in Bristol last year for half a season on loan,
which did him an awful lot of good, didn't it?
Oh, it made him. It absolutely made him. I mean, in every way, he grew as a person. He'll say that himself. It was phenomenal. And playing under Pat Lam and playing in that Bristol backline with the, you know, two Fijians and a South African. I mean, the speed of that backline is something else, you know. And I think that Harry found that really, really enormously beneficial.
Okay, well, look, I just wanted to ask you about them because a lot of people would know you as their father as well, so I thought it would be good to throw it in. You've had a fascinating career. You have a really fascinating story.
It's not over yet.
That's the attitude. No. Pat Byrne, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Magnified.
Magnified with Matt Cooper, sponsored by Intact Insurance, the new name for RSA Insurance, offering personal and commercial cover with ease.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
Finding a hoodie that lasts through the season can be tough. The American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it year after year. The iconic Classic Full Zip Hoodie is the jacket that started it all for American Giant. Custom heavyweight fleece and side panels for mobility make it the best hoodie ever. Every American Giant piece is made in America and designed to last. No exceptions. The result is durable clothing, like the premium Slub Crew Tee, No BS high-rise pant and slim roughneck pant that become part of your life. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life. The American Giant Classic Full Zip. Save 20% off your first order at american-giant.com when you use staple 20 at checkout.